As you approach the podium and get settled, as all parties are aware, the appellant's counsel will have 15 minutes for their argument in chief. The respondent will have 15 minutes for their argument. And then finally, appellant will have 5 minutes of rebuttal if you wish to exercise it. As soon as you get settled and organized, you can just approach the podium. It goes up and down. You can adjust the microphone to your level. And please just begin by telling us who you are in a loud, clear voice, please.
Good morning, Your Honors. First of all, thank you for taking the time to listen to this case and consider our appeal. I'm Steve Lindloff. I represent Jerry Linderuth, the appellant. And before I begin with any arguments or statements of the case, I would like to take this opportunity to correct the record. In our brief, we claimed in issue 1B that we had raised an issue of reservation of spouse maintenance at trial, and in our motion for amended findings. Upon review of the record, I found that that was a mistake. We did not raise that issue. So I would like to correct that record and apologize to the court.
Thank you for your candor, counsel.
There is three main issues that my client has raised in his brief. Did the court err in not awarding any permanent spouse maintenance? Did the court err in valuing the respondent's MSRS state pension when it heavily discounted the marital share of that pension? And third, did the court err in choosing a date of valuation for the assets, the year 2007, which was the date that the party separated, instead of the pretrial date before the trial that was held last year in 2018? And even if this court should find that there was not an error in choosing that valuation date of 2007, did the trial court err in failing to adjust the assets awarded to the parties and taking into consideration that the two main assets that were awarded to the appellant decreased significantly since the date of valuation and the date of trial? And again, the valuation date as chosen by the trial court was 2007. The day of the trial was 2018. So there was about 11 years difference. Briefly, the history of this case is that the trial took place over 2 days in March of last year, 2018, in Brainerd, Minnesota. After the court issued its decree, the appellant moved for amended findings and or a new trial, which was denied by the trial court with a one-paragraph order, and then this appeal followed. In regards to the first issue, spouse maintenance, I'd like to point out some of the facts we think are relevant. The appellant, Mr. Jerry Linderuth, worked full-time throughout his life until he was fired in 2007. I think it was March of 2007.
Of all the facts that you're reciting as far as this marital history, what are you claiming that Judge Tenike erred in terms of his consideration of your request for permanent spousal maintenance? He was aware of the fact that your client was disabled. He was aware of the respective incomes of the parties. He looked at the standard of living that the parties had, and so on. So what I'm getting at is, where was the mistake that would cause us to reconsider your request for permanent spousal maintenance?
Well, Your Honor, we think there are a number of mistakes. Now, they're spelled out in the brief, but mainly ever since my client became disabled in 2007, pursuant to the 2009 finding of the Supreme Social Security Administration that he was 100% disabled and unable to find any work in the economy. His income was limited to a Social Security disability income of about $1,700 a month.
But what troubles me is when we have these cases and we have a district court judge that specifically determines credibility issues, we have a determination by this judge that your client was able to meet his needs and that his expenses either were inflated or his testimony about what his claimed expenses were incredible. And we're reviewing court. We don't decide maintenance as a first issue. We look to see what did the district court do wrong, if anything.
All right, Your Honor, let me address that. And I was trying to get to that. As the facts showed, my client took all his expenses off of his bank account in 2017, and they averaged $2,400 a month. His income during that year was $1,800 a month. He had a gap of $600 a month, and he met that gap by taking $600 a month out of his savings or his inheritance. The judge found that some of his claimed expenses weren't credible. I've reviewed the facts and I've reviewed the findings, and I don't understand how the judge reached that. He talked about how there were certain expenses that were double counted, but he didn't explain how they were double counted, and in fact, they weren't double counted. All those expenses in his expense account were all singly tabulated. And so if he claimed there were food expenses taken out of cash.
Well, one thing you claimed, the budget includes a provision for vacations. The competing testimony came from the respondent in this case, and she said the whole time we were together, we had three vacations. So the standard of living is something the judge is going to determine based on the credibility presentations. So that was one aspect of it. What evidence did you have that he needed to budget for vacations? If there's no marital history of vacations.
There was some history, but I'd like to clarify that point. His actual expense budget of $2,400 was what he actually spent each month the year before trial. And then he included some additional expenses on his wish list that he wanted to add to that $2,400. One of them was for vacation, and he wanted to add $250 a month to that.
We all want to wish for something that, if you haven't used it for 10 years and you haven't needed it for 10 years, we all wish we could have something more and better.
Well, he couldn't afford it. His income was limited to Social Security disability, and he
testified. But if they never took vacations during the marriage, because the testimony, as I understand it, was they lived paycheck to paycheck, and he didn't dispute that testimony, because you're divorced doesn't mean you have a better standard of living.
No, but they had used most of their savings put into retirement. Their plan was once they got retired, they would enjoy life and vacation. She was, the respondent was over 65. He was reaching 65 one year after trial. It was assumed during their whole marriage that the reason they put all this money into their pensions and retirement accounts was to be able to enjoy life and take vacations. And so that was his wish. Unfortunately, during the last 10 or 11 years, he was unable to save for that. But the vacation was one of the expenses. Another expense he asked for was a vehicle expense. And he had testified that he was still driving the 02 truck that he had when the party separated in 07. And he said it was getting too old to continue running. He was putting too much expense into it and repairs. And in fact, he said he needed to replace, but he was unable to afford it. Like I say, his income was limited to the Social Security disability for the 5 years before trial. The respondent testified that she had bought a car shortly before trial, and she put a $250 or $350 expense for the loan for that newer car into her budget, and the trial court accepted that. So it seems very fair that the appellant should have the same expense, especially under the consideration that he was still driving the old 02 truck, which was 16 years old at the time, and it was clear he could not afford a truck payment. He didn't have the income. Another expense he had requested was for the Medicare supplemental plan.
But he's never taken advantage of that Medicare supplemental plan. So again, is that the wish list, one of his wish list things?
Well, it was an expense that the respondent had claimed would be on her future expense once she retired from the state. And she listed a $292 a month payment for that Medicare supplemental plan. My client was going to reach 65 this year in March, a little bit after the trial. And so he thought if it was fair for the respondent to claim that expense, he would certainly need it too once he was off her insurance and he'd reached the age of 65 when he would need a supplemental plan. So all he was seeking was fairness between the both parties and their budgets. That's why he claimed that expense. And that seems reasonable to me. I mean, one of our objections was that the trial court seemed to treat the parties differently. On the one hand, one party gets an expense for a newer vehicle. On the other hand, the other party doesn't. On the one hand, party gets a supplemental medical expense. On the other hand, the party doesn't. Now, the other interesting thing about vacations is that the respondent's income after trial, when she retired, was going to be about $5,200 a month. She claimed her expenses would be about $2,800 to $2,900. Now, that leaves a gap of about $2,200. Now, she did not have to list vacation expenses in her budget because she had $2,200 extra past what she stated in her needs to cover those expenses. And I guess it would make sense to me not to add those to her budget, because otherwise that would give an excuse for the trial court to consider the same expense for the appellant. But the appellant didn't have that gravy on top of his income to cover those expenses that he would have loved to pay for.
What was the abuse of discretion that the judge had as far as the valuation date? I mean, after all, these parties had been living apart for, I think it was the 10-year period, without anything to do with each other, as far as I understand the record. Why should the judge have used that later valuation date?
A couple of reasons. One,
I'd say the district court has great discretion.
Well, it does, but if it chooses a valuation date different from the pretrial date, as the statute states, it's got to make specific findings to support that different valuation date. Now, the only finding I could find that made sense was the trial court stated that neither party was significantly affected or otherwise
been apart for 10 years.
Right. But their situation apparently hadn't changed according to the trial court.
So we as an appellate court then would decide if there was an abuse of discretion in the judge using that reasoning to support the valuation date that he selected.
Right. Well, the reason we thought it wasn't fair to use an earlier date was just based on fairness and equity. In 2007, my client became 100% disabled, and he was unable to work after that, per the findings of the administration from the Social Security. He could not add to his retirement accounts after 2007. And we all are aware that in 2007 and 2008, the real estate market dropped significantly. I mean, the court can take judicial notice of that fact. So the house that was awarded to him dropped significantly in value after 2007. And then his other major asset that was awarded to him was a 401k plan, and he had to withdraw $70,000 from that account in 07, 08, and 09 to support himself until he started getting Social Security disability at the beginning of 2010. And so he decreased the value of both his assets really through no fault of his own, except in regards to the house and his failure to maintain it and repair it. But he also testified that the reason he couldn't repair it and maintain it, even though he had those skills prior to his disability, was because of his disability, his physical and mental disability. His disability was pretty significant. One doctor said it was like he'd had a lot of mini strokes in his brain. He had a valve and a shunt put in his brain. And as I say, the administration from Social Security stated that there was really no work that he could perform, and that was a result of his neurological evaluation from 2008. So for the last 10 years, he had been getting by on the disability and going into his savings and his pension to support himself, waiting for the time when he might be able to enjoy part of the respondent's state pension, which was their major asset. Now, that brings me to the second issue, which is how the trial court valued that MSRS state pension. The exhibit introduced by the respondent, that was the pension valuation, said it had a total present value right before the trial of nearly $600,000. We didn't disagree with that, but where we disagreed was how the trial court came up with a marital value of $155,000. Now, that's about a fourth of the total value of that pension. Now, how did the court arrive at that number?
There was an expert that testified to that number, wasn't there?
There was no expert that testified, just the report came in.
The report. There wasn't an objection to the report that was received as evidence of what her her expert would have opined.
Well, that's true, but when the evidence was introduced, I didn't object to the introduction of that report, but I did state to the trial judge that we certainly had issues with some of the conclusions of that report, and we would address those conclusions of the report in our trial memorandum, which we did. So we didn't agree that all the facts in that report were accurate. We didn't agree that the reason was accurate. And regardless, it's up to the trial court to determine what the actual value is and make sense of it. Now, I've been able to find...
Lindelof, I have let you go on a little bit, so you will have rebuttal.
Sure.
Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you, Your Honor.
You're welcome. We'll now hear from counsel for the respondent, please.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Kennard Hunt, and I represent the respondent, Cindy Linneruth. The trial court did not abuse its discretion in assigning the December 1, 2007 as the valuation date in its division of marital assets, and there was no abuse of discretion in denying appellant spousal maintenance. Accordingly, respondent requests affirmance. As of December 1, 2007, the parties went their separate ways physically and financially. Each party made their own financial decisions and lived in the manner he or she chose. In utilizing the December 1, 2007 valuation date, the trial court divided the marital assets so each party retained that which they had in 2007, and by awarding the marital homestead to appellant, appellant obtained approximately $100,000 more in marital assets than that of respondent. When the financial resources of appellant, including marital property, apportioned to him, appellant has the ability to meet his needs given the marital standard of living. The trial court did not abuse its discretion in denying spousal maintenance. Now, the record stands undisputed. The parties had a very modest marital standard of living. There is no testimony in the record to this notion that somehow upon retirement, they had these plans to go on these broad vacation. There's nothing at all like that in the record, which I heard the appellant argue this morning. The fact of the matter is that during their marriage, they took very few vacations. They went to see respondent's sibling in Colorado, where they stayed for free. So that is the extent of their vacations during the marriage. They lived paycheck to paycheck, with respondent having multiple jobs to support herself. They had mortgage debt. They had credit card debt of over $16,000. They had no savings other than what they put in their employment-related retirement plans. They had multiple vehicles, but all had substantial loans on them with little to no equity. So, and when, like I said, when the parties took vacations, they were few, they went out to eat maybe twice a month. Now, under the judgment and decree, appellant leaves the marriage, he has no debt. He has been given credit for the payment of the homestead mortgage and the amount of non-marital funds that he used for the home. He has the house, And with the Social Security disability benefits, which became Social Security when he turned 65, plus the Weyerhaeuser pension, he makes about $2,000 a month. And he has available his 401k plan and any investment income from his investment accounts. In addition, while on disability, appellant did earn additional income.
I was wondering if you could, the district court, you know, specifically said, well, you know, I don't find these expenses, or Mr. Lindlaw's client's husband's expenses, credible. Is there an, can you tell us from the record what, which ones was he talking about? It was a little unclear to me. He didn't buy them, but I was just kind of wondering, why didn't he buy them?
He didn't buy them. I think if you look at the statement before that, he's talking about the fact that they're, like, he'll have a category for gasoline, but then he'll assert, well, I have all this for cash, and I would spend it on gasoline. So, I mean, you had this where you had categories, and but then he, they don't really match up to what he testifies to in terms of cash. And what I saw, and I put it in my respondent's brief, when you kind of go through what he presented, I mean, you have a situation where he's buying, you know, like $100 worth of gas in a day. I mean, it doesn't make any sense. I mean, he's not employed. And so there's a clear reason why the trial court did not find it credible. The other thing is that with regard to the expenses, and the fact of the matter is that appellant did do some work otherwise. He, outside, he had disability, but he did some wild rice harvesting. And actually, before his disability kicked in, he went back to doing his job of painting homes. So he actually was able to do some employment. So he actually was able to supplement his income. And he testified at trial that he was, you know, willing to supplement his income with part-time employment. So when you look at the fact that the trial court finds that his reasonable monthly expenses are lower than what he claims, you have what his income is from disability, you have, he'll have interest income on his investments, he can supplement it with, you know, limited part-time work, but it will cover it, that clearly he doesn't have the need for spousal maintenance. So there really isn't an abuse of discretion here. Nor did the trial court, you know, abuse its discretion in its view of how it assigned value to the marital assets. We have the expert's report. It states how the state retirement plan was valued. There was no competing report put into evidence by the appellant. There really wasn't any cross-examination of that report. I mean, the report speaks for itself. And on the basis of the record, there is nothing in the findings of the trial court that are in any respect clearly erroneous, nor is there any abuse of discretion here by the trial court. So respondent respectfully requests that this court in all respects affirm the district court.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Nordhunt. Mr. Lindlaw, you'll have the last word, sir.
Thank you, Your Honors.
You're welcome.
Thank you again for the time spent on this case. Appreciate it.
You know, I'll get right to the point, Mr. Lindhoff. I find Ms. Nordhunt's argument is convincing. Why is she wrong?
Well, in regards to the spousal maintenance argument, Your Honor, it's clear that the appellant's budget was created strictly from every dollar he spent during 2007, right from his bank accounts. Now, if there was any...
The district court had some concern, well, made credibility determinations, which is always kind of a red flag for us that, you know, I'm not going to overturn that. Ms. Nordhunt explained, okay, you know, if he's not really working, well, if he's disabled, you know, how is he? And he's doing a lot of this stuff just with cash. And he's saying that I'm spending $100 a day on gas. Well, that does seem ridiculous. So
it does, Your Honor. So
right off the bat, then, if his expenses are lower than what he's claiming, and there's a reason the court rejected the higher expenses, and then it's kind of about equal, and I totally get it. He's disabled, but you know, it seems to me if his expenses are approximately equal to the income, and there's a possibility for a little bit more income, then I don't think it was an abuse of discretion for the district court to say your client doesn't get maintenance.
Well, Your Honor, the example I heard about the gas spending $100 in one day is one day out of 365, and that's answered if he came down to the cities, talked to his lawyer, or he had some other excuse like that. That's just taking one day out of 365 to create an argument is invalid. The court did the same thing. The one example it gave was something about food. Now, in looking at the facts, his food expense for the year under that category was like $82 or something. It was very low just because most of his food and gas expenses were in that cash envelope. That's where he spent most of his day-to-day expenses, in that cash. He'd go and get cash, then he'd spend it during the day on food, clothes, gas, everything else he normally would pay. Now, we did create other categories for some of those same things just because that's how he marked up the expenses on his bank account. For example, one of the categories we put down, I can't remember if it was gas or something else, there are only four or five examples of that expense during the year. And they only added up to maybe $100, $150, which is 10 to 15 a month. So the court basically took that argument from proposed findings from the other party and put it into the final order of the court. But it didn't have any basis in fact. It was de minimis. And the fact that he was continuously going into a savings in the amount of $600 a month to meet just the bare bones expenses is really the telling issue. And there's been cases that have said that nobody should have to get by on their bare-boned expenses. Now, something else I want to say is, again, I tried to find a court case that would support how the court arrived at this $155 value for the MSRS. The court apparently discounted the marital value. How it arrived at that discount of, I think, 59%, I don't know. The report says something about it, but you can't figure out from the report how it came to that. And if it was okay to discount the marital portion of that pension, why wasn't a discount applied to the 14 years she had before the marriage, right? I mean, you've got to have fairness here if you're going to use these. And it's up to the trial court and the other party to meet their burden of proof to show what's marital and non-marital, and they didn't do it. The numbers just don't add up, and there is no supportive case law or statute in the other brief to support that discount from a $600,000 valued asset to $155,000 when the parties lived together before their separation for about 19 years or half the time. How does that happen? And again, there's cases we've cited in our brief that talks about how no party should have to get by with their bare-boned expenses. I mean, this gentleman was existing on his bare-boned expenses through the whole time after he was disabled until the divorce decree was filed. And I'm sure he thought he was going to get a part of her estate pension because that was the major asset. You add up all the values of the assets, they don't equal the $600,000 value of that one state pension.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Your time is up. The matter is submitted. That being our last case of the day, we are adjourned.
All rise.
Heard of that good thing.
was glad you agreed to move it down here.
Oh, especially on a day like today.
Right, yeah.
We would have been carpooling.
We would have been.
Yeah, when I saw the weather, I told Jerry not to drive down for this.
Yeah.
Not worth it. Well, I guess I got to go light some candles at the church.